Good morning, and welcome to United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. This morning we are going to talk about a subject which all of us hold very dear to our hearts, and that is finding the value and meaning of suffering. And we find that during this entire month of February, we are talking about life problems and theosophical solutions to those problems. But why would these solutions be any different than any other solutions that we have sought to alleviate all through our lives? Well, the reason being that theosophy is the accumulated wisdom of the ages. And the knowledge that is garnered in theosophy through that accumulated wisdom is not of any one person or a select group of people, but it is through the perceptions of generations of perfected beings. For theosophy holds that we are all perfectible, and that in earlier times of our evolution, this knowledge was known and taught among the people. And through the cycle, it has been lost or hidden. And then periodically it is revealed. And we are living in such a cycle where there is freedom of expression, of thought, and of action. So in keeping with this, this lodge in Philadelphia is open to the public for no other reason than to keep before the public these fundamental truths about man and his origin. Now, to do this, we must become fierce in our devotion to these ideas, and independent of all others. For this is a journey which each of us must take, not through someone else, but by ourselves. And we are led along the way by others who have pointed out the direction we are to follow. And that is why on the book table in the hallway between us and the library are books that we can find that will help us on this journey. They are guidebooks. But like anything else, there has to be a fundamental basis, a fundamental principles on which we look at these truths. And as theosophists, our aim is to disseminate these fundamental ideas amongst humanity. And that these truths will make self-evident the reality of the self within. And this self within shows us the reality of universal brotherhood. For everyone is of the same essence, only differing in degree. We are all souls. Now, to come together, as we see in nations and families and civilizations, there has to be a basis for this union. Well, the basis for this union are these three fundamental ideas. But within this basis, there is a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and is followed by all. And these teachings are placed before the public by the messengers of this teaching, who were on the scene in the last, or not last century, now it's two centuries ago, that put into writing these ancient ideas, these ancient truths, these ancient secrets that the profane world was not ready for, but have been deemed the time is now ripe for the world to hear these ideas and make them living powers in our lives. And that is found and embodied in service. And through theosophy, we can be true servants of humanity, for ideas rule the world. And by freeing the minds of man, suffering will end. And all of you are welcome. And you will always be welcome in these rooms. For by making ourselves better able to help and teach others, we become true workers for humanity. Now we do this in Philadelphia on Wednesday evenings. We keep these doors open, where we are studying together the Ocean of Theosophy, a compilation of letters and articles written by William Q. Judge in the 1800s, which is a synthesis, if that is possible, of the secret doctrine, but the basic ideas that are followed within that document. And we study them together to raise ourselves up to be better able to help. And also, on Wednesday evenings, we have a library. It's a reference library, and there's always someone available in that room to help and aid you in your searching for truth and for answers to questions that you may have. As I said, there's a table between the library and this room that has straight-line theosophical books, pamphlets, and magazines that are available for purchase at cost. For it is said that this philosophy is the birthright of every human being. So no money is ever asked for profit. It's just the publication and printing of these articles. Because we cannot sell these ideas. And beware to those who do. Then on Sunday mornings, which is self-evident, we have a class from 11 a.m. to 12 noon. The doors open at 10:30, where we take up a theme for each month. And as was mentioned, our theme for this month is life problems and theosophical solutions. And next week, we are going to take up the idea or the problems with pride and prejudice. And then the last Sunday of February the 27th, we're going to take up the idea of how fear and doubt block progress. Now we also, through the endeavor of our independent devotion, there is a Theosophical Independence, which is a newsletter, which is published each month. And it takes up a theme appropriate to that time of year, to the cycle. And we have available volumes 9, 10, and 11 for December and January of this year. They are free to the public, and you're given the opportunity to take them home if you like. Now, one other thing is that because there is nothing that is expected of each of us, only that which we expect of ourselves, all the activities of this lodge are carried on through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. There's no obligation implied or inferred, only that which one feels for himself he or she needs to do. The opportunity is just presented. It is for us to act upon it as best we see fit for the better service of humanity. Now, this morning's talk is one that has filled many of our minds, mostly unwanted, but it has filled our minds. This idea of suffering. Why do we suffer? Is there any meaning to it? And most of our life is spent in trying to avoid it. But this morning we'll find out that there is true value to be gathered from this human experience. So this morning we'll have a talk presenting these ideas, and then we'll have questions and answers afterwards.
The most common experience of life is connected with suffering. All men and women suffer. The pang of the heart, the agony of the mind, and the disease of the body are all too common in ourselves or in others. Each one of us has sorrow in his life, but each also has their share of happiness and pleasure. If we harp on our poverty and misery and forget our joys and happiness, it is because of a psychological reason. We humans are awakened much more by our pain and sorrows than by our pleasurable experiences. We sit up and take notice when things go wrong. Happiness for ourselves seems natural to us. Within our own soul there is bliss, and therefore it seems quite natural to experience joy. But this naturalness has bred a kind of apathy. We take our pleasures for granted and do not learn from them. But when pain and afflictions come, we sit up and take notice. Let us consider an idea held by so many that wealth is the womb of happiness and poverty begets suffering. False as it might seem, there is an underlying truth in this belief. We are apt, especially in this civilization, when economics and politics are the dominating forces, to look upon wealth only from the point of view of billions and billions and stocks and bonds. We tend to overlook the important fact that the real value of money lies in the use we make of it, what we can purchase with it, what comfort can we derive from it. But there are other kinds of wealth. There is a mental wealth, and there is an emotional purchase. For a small amount, we can purchase a copy of the Gita or the Dhammapada. But the joy and inspiration one derives for days and months and years is priceless. So it is not just money that gives us enjoyment, but the power to use money to secure that which to us means happiness. This is an important idea, and that is twofold. Happiness depends not on money, but on the use we make of money. And two, the capacity of using money is within ourselves. What is true of happiness is equally true of its opposite, suffering. Suffering is the result, not of economic poverty, but of lack of capacity to use that which we already possess and to obtain that which at present we do not possess. The capacity of using poverty is within us. The very common phenomena of the rich who are unhappy and of the poor who are contented and happy further proves that the real source of happiness and suffering is within ourselves, and that wealth is of many kinds. Spiritual wealth of the heart, mental wealth of the head, and economic wealth. These three kinds of wealth are related to three kinds of happiness and three kinds of sorrow. But one thing is common to all three, and that is that the power or capacity to obtain and to use these wealths lies within ourselves. A person earns his living by the sweat of his brow. By his effort, he begets his food, clothing, and shelter. But it's also said that man does not live by bread alone. One has to create mental and spiritual wealth and to make the right use of that wealth. To create a wealth is one factor, to make the right use of it is another. There are many who earn good money but are not very happy, nor have they banished misery and suffering from their body, mind, and heart. The Gita teaches that light and darkness are the world's eternal ways. Nature as a whole is neither good nor evil. The light of day is not more or less valuable. It's not more or less valuable than the darkness of night. The flow of the tide is as available and as valuable as the ebb. Summer is also as useful as winter. Spirit and matter are not two different realities, but two poles of the one life. Just as our globe, the earth, has two poles, North Pole, South Pole. And without both, there would be no globe. So also in the universe are spirit and matter. Everywhere in nature, in all things and all beings, spirit and matter exist. Representative aspects of both are present in every adept and in every atom. Only the proportion of these aspects is different in an adept. The spirit aspect is more active than the matter aspect. In the mineral, the matter aspect is more active. In man, spirit and matter are both equally represented. As a result of this, there springs into being that which we call the thinking, reasoning, self-determining human soul. Because of the presence of free will, man has the power to choose and to determine. Being in that middle position, he can go in either of two directions. He can soar spiritward or drift into the abyss of matter. It is man and no one else who is the creator of that which we call good and evil, happiness and suffering. Man himself creates his own suffering. Why should men who deserve happiness create suffering? The answer, simply put, is because suffering is necessary. To understand and appreciate light, we need to experience darkness. Theosophy teaches that to evaluate beauty, we need to contact its opposite. Similarly, to experience the supreme and sublime bliss of nirvana, we need to experience the sorrow and suffering of material existence. That is why we create suffering to begin with. Whatever suffering is ours today, was created by us in the past. We are reaping today the effects of seeds sown by us earlier. Weaknesses and ailments of the body, defects of character, limitations of the mind are all the results of our own thoughts, words, deeds. Past deeds, past desires, past ideas have produced our present body, character, mind, and also our circumstances and environment. So just how, by what precise method, do we create all this? The Buddha answered that, and so does the Gita, and the answer of theosophy is the same. The Buddha said that the cause of sorrow, the second of his Four Noble Truths, is desire, and the cause of desire is kamma. The very first idea to grasp, and which is often neglected, is if kamma, desire, produces suffering and sorrow, its reverse must produce happiness and joy. If kamma, desire, anger, covetousness are the gates of hell, as the Gita teaches, then compassion, which is the reverse of passion, patience, the reverse of anger, generosity, the reverse of greed, must be the gates to heaven. So we create suffering by the forces of desires, and we create happiness by the force of aspirations. We make a mistake ignorantly and bring suffering upon ourselves. When we refuse to learn the lesson of our mistake and obstinately persist in it, we bring upon ourselves greater misery and suffering. Because of ignorance of our own nature and of our own human constitution, we are deluded by that which we call pleasure. Most men and women think of pleasure and happiness in terms of their senses. For instance, what tastes good is eaten without any consideration to the value of the food. We indulge because it gives us a thrill to our palate, and then pain comes. We know it and yet continue to indulge in it. Thus, evil tendencies are confirmed and roots of misery are strengthened. The meaning of suffering has to be traced by us every time to ignorance or obstinacy. The vice of obstinacy is subtle. An obstinate person thinks he has a strong will. He is apt to make his vices look like virtues. Theosophy teaches that he has to acquire knowledge and give up his obstinacy in terms of knowledge, and he will understand the meaning of suffering and be able to overcome it. To overcome suffering, I'll put it positively and constructively, by acquiring knowledge and by adaptability. Knowledge helps us to overcome the force of evil within, and adaptability enables us to control the forces which act as irritants and arouse the evil in us, the evil we are trying to curb and control. So the first lesson is that suffering is necessary. It awakens the soul. It educates the real man. Suffering results from ignorance, from failure to learn from a previous experience of suffering. Obstinate persistence is old and outworn ways which no more can teach us, and which we know to be wrong, brings us the bitterest suffering. Secondly, by the force of desire in us, we make our own suffering. It is not forced upon us by some outside God or by people we contact. Third, because we ourselves create our own suffering, we alone must overcome it. By the power of aspirations, the highest aspect of desire, we frustrate ignorance, illusion, and delusion. The voice of flesh brings misery. The voice of conscience brings warning. The voice of the soul brings happiness. One more thought. Without deliberate practice, no one can overcome pain and suffering. No one can bring about real joy of the heart and peace of the mind. We must work for our spiritual wealth, just as we have labored to earn our livelihood. Theosophy gives us adequate tools for gaining the knowledge for this task. We have but to avail and to apply that knowledge. And lastly, from that great philosopher, Helen Reddy. Oh yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I've gained. If I have to, I can do anything. Topic for today, finding the value and meaning of suffering.
Yes.
It would seem that the greatest suffering and the most painful experience in the natural world is a human woman giving childbirth. Why is that the case?
Well, considering the idea, we don't know. We've never given birth.
In this life. Say anything?
Well, if we would use analogy that anything of greatness comes through suffering, and giving birth is the greatest of all service that one can render to humanity. So the fact that the struggle and the pain associated with childbirth are so great is probably a prelude to life. But if you would ask the women in this room who have given birth, that moment is extremely painful, but it's a fleeting image. It's a fleeting pain because it's not something that you go, oh, I can remember how painful it was, and go on day and day and day and keep on remembering that pain. It is a fleeting pain. It is a we would think it's a process, as life is a process, and that moment of birth, being that it is painful, it is it's a great moment. It's a very meaningful moment, and it's one that is a example of service, of how we are indebted to each other, because we're certainly indebted to our mothers, or we wouldn't be here. And if they hadn't suffered the pain of childbirth, we wouldn't be here. So there's that example of service that we are born into.
It does say in the Secret Doctrine, and one would have to do research to understand it, that it is not normal for the human female in giving birth to suffer pain. That I think there's an expression, something was bruised or something in the human nature, and it caused this reaction. The men in this room have been women and have probably given birth, and probably know it's not birth that's painful, it's the hard work that leads up to the birth, which is why we call it labor. So it isn't that the woman doesn't remember the pain, it's that she remembers the result. And a child is worth any pain to almost any family. So it also depends on the circumstances. We experienced a natural childbirth 52 years ago, this month, and it was magical. But we also had a birth where we died and the child died, and we had a birth where the child was born premature, and those were painful. So it also has to do with circumstances, the attitude of the mother, and the fact that it's a karmic condition for humanity, whatever we've done wrong.
Nothing can quite top experience.
We remember learning being amazed that when an animal that's born through an egg is ready to come out, it must crack and break the shell itself or it won't survive. If it is helped at all in that process of breaking free, it perishes. So So it reminds us of a favorite quote from Khalil Gibran, that your pain or suffering is the breaking of the shell of your understanding. And our question would be, what might that understanding be that we're seeking through this necessary suffering?
Well, the breaking of the understanding that we have. We find that in Buddhism, that they use a word called dukkha, which means that the world is impermanent. It's empty. It has no meaning. And that the causes of a suffering or of our pain is our attachment or our ideas that we hold about how things are or how they should be. So here we are in these rooms, and what has brought us here? Pain and suffering. The ideas that we've held, we know that they couldn't be the truth. Why is the world filled with such suffering? Why is there such pain and agony? Why is there such brutality? Why is there such derision? Why are religions so divisive? Why? And it's pain that has led us to this door. Because this can't be the reality. As we said about childbirth, well, our reality is that it's painful. But in reality, it's not. But only through our ideas that we have held to be true have things become painful. What idea more than the fact that there is an outside God who controls us, who we have to pay homage to, that's wrathful? How much pain has that caused? We know it has caused great pain because it has caused great pain for us, each of us, that we've held that idea. Or that vicarious atonement, that someone else can die for my sins, that I have ultimately, I can be cleared of all my wrongdoing by one attrition, by one saying, well, forgive me, I didn't mean that. No. So we go on doing the things that we've done and not changing. It's the ideas that we hold that have caused us the most most suffering. If we can embrace the idea that this world is empty, emptiness is all around us. And what do? We fill it up. We give it meaning. It has no meaning other than what we give it. So if our meaning is that there's an outside God, that we've evolved from an animal, from an ape, or that we can be absolved of our sins by one outside of us, we're in pain because they're false ideas. And they only breed more pain and suffering. The key to this talk this morning is finding. Finding. We have to look. We have to want to know. We have to look within and see where what is the cause of this suffering that I'm enduring. I'm enduring this personal lie, because that's the only way we look within.
So where do we begin our search? It's easy to reject everything as false and ideas that don't make sense. But then how do we make sense of it? And then how do we help others?
Well, is it so easy to reject the ideas that are false? Because we live in a world filled with false ideas. So you're constantly finding resistance. No matter where you go and where you express these ideas, there's resistance. So resistance, what does resistance do? It builds strength. And it makes us try to find reasonable answers to questions which our family members present to us. Because that's what we're first presented with, our resistance. Because we've come from families that love us, that care about us, that have thought that they've given us the best that they can. And here we come along saying, I'm not so sure these ideas are right.
Well, we personally found the ideas easy to reject, but we've had difficulty finding replacements for these ideas.
Well, that's the key, because if you don't find replacements for the ideas, they're not going to go away. It's like a habit. If you want to stop a habit, you've got to find something to replace that habit. Somewhere to direct your mind off of that tendency. So I think perhaps one of the best gifts we are given when we walk into these rooms is we're asked to suspend those beliefs that we've come in here with and just try to open your mind, let it free for a moment, just to consider these ideas, consider them. But the mind, when it finds something that's true, doesn't let it go. Even if it's against what we think is true, we find ourselves considering it and weighing it and trying to find the truth in it. And no better example of that is than reincarnation. Because none of us, or few of us, have grown up with this idea in our families. And only if we did, we only heard the word. It was never explained to us. And now we come into these rooms and we're saying, well, this is one of the laws of the universe. This is one of the laws that we need to understand. And, you know, then we sort of stop and we think, well, yeah, how can that be? But we begin to consider it. And we begin to see how this law, this reality, permeates all of life, as well as man, but all the other kingdoms and all the other worlds, all the other planets. Everything revolves around this idea.
Choices to make decisions that can bring us either happiness or suffering. But what about being checked by karma? Where does that fit into this whole idea then?
Well, why are you where you are now? Why are any of us where we are now? We have these ideas, and why can't we just go ahead and express them? Why can't we clean up our lower natures? Clean up our minds? Why do we have these stupid tendencies that keep on drawing us in all kinds of different directions? Well, tendencies, karmic propensities, things that are unresolved in our nature that keep on coming to us. And here's an opportunity for us to set them right. Oftentimes, we don't even see the tendency that is blocking us because it is so part of our nature. And then when we have a friend who sees our weaknesses, we would love them to tell us on one hand, and on the other hand, we're going, don't you dare. Don't you dare. Don't strip me naked, not in front of you, because we have this false image of who we are. And we live that life. And little by little, we chip it away. Little by little. Oftentimes in anger, someone will speak the truth to us. Oh. We don't want to hear that. And if we do hear it, it resonates. Because if it upsets us, we know it's true. We don't want to admit it. And we don't want anyone else to see it. But the funny thing is, everybody sees it. We don't. But because we are so tolerant of each other, we do not scrutinize and find fault with each other. What kind of world would that be? That we're all constantly pointing out each other's faults. No fun. No fun. And we are told that let people alone. Let them work it out. And sure, you can probably assist in small ways or in large ways, but only if the moment is right. The opportunity is there. You do not want to strip away someone's belief in the religion that they hold and give them nothing to hang on to. Whatever it is that makes people strong, you don't want to take that away from them. But you want to give them ideas in which they can perhaps become stronger. But you don't want to tell them that they're wrong. What they do is not correct. That you're better than them. You know more than them. We can't do that. We can't set ourselves up above anyone else, because all of our friends, all of our family, we know how they feel because we've been there. We've lived with these ideas. We've lived with people who think that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, they'll beat the crap out of you if you do something wrong. You know, all these things we've all endured in some way, if not mentally, if physically. We've been abused in some way and blocked. But as stated, it's karma. It's cause and effect. Whether we deserve it or not is not the question. It's the fact that it's happening and it's done. So what is the value of that? What can I learn from it? Not that that person's a... you know, and be angry with them because of what they've done to us. Well, we need to say, thank you. Thank you, because you've shown me something about myself that I don't want to see, and I certainly don't want to deal with. But because you've reacted in such a way, and I've reacted in such a way, it is right here in front of us. Now, either you find the meaning of it, or you go on suffering, and no resolution.
It's our understanding that periodically over ages, certain beings are born into this world and they bring a message to suffering humanity and put it in a vernacular that we can quickly understand. It's a wake-up call. So, being born here, something goes to sleep and is overcome by that very birth. Theosophy, in a short way, is saying to wake up. And we hear such terms as a spiritual being, voluntary and involuntary. And when we begin to wake up, we realize we have a responsibility. So pain and pleasure, differences, are we those differences, or are we a witness of these feelings? And if we are, what is our real duty in being here?
Well, we know that we are observers. We see life unfold all around us. And we are a witness to that. So, if we're witnessing it, we know we are not that. We are more than that. We are greater than that. We are not these bodies. We are not these circumstances. We are not all the things that we see going on around us. We are witness to them. Now, what happens is that we think we are them. We are these feelings. We are these ideas. And we defend them. We react to them. We hold them up as the truth. We fill our lives up with meaning. But the meaning is that we are one. We are one. We are not separate from each other. And that meaning is so hard for us to grasp because look at the reality. We are separate. We're separate. You're sitting there, you're sitting there, I'm sitting here. We're separate. But that's the illusion. Because we are all sharing now an idea, a thought, an understanding. So, what does that do? That makes us one. That makes us one. So the illusion is the physical appearance. The reality is that mental expression of that spiritual idea. So life has no meaning. The Buddha said this. It has no meaning. It is empty. And we fill it up with meaning. We give it meaning. And unfortunately, or fortunately, we've come into this life and we are into a family, into a community where certain ideas are held to be true. So as children, we emulate those ideas. We adopt these ideas. They're not original to us. We've been given these ideas by our mother and father, and by their friends and those around us in the schoolyard. And, you know, our life took on meaning at a very early age. And things happened at a very, very early age that we reacted in a certain way. Well, we are still reacting in that way, same way, because we have never resolved the earliest memory of that situation. Someone beat us up. Someone separated us. Someone bullied us. Someone did this. Someone did that. And we made a resolution then and there how we were going to deal with that. And we did that in our mind. So our mind developed a hindrance, something that's blocking it from knowing the truth. But we do it as a defense mechanism, because oftentimes our first recollections of our own reality, of being witnesses, we know we're witnesses as children. We witness the life around us. We begin to wonder, how do we control that? Or how do we make some kind of impression in that world in which we are witness to? And that's the beginning of our pain and our suffering.
Just piggybacking on what you were saying, with me, like, sometimes I'm giving value something that really has no value. I'm being caught up on something that somebody says that really, really means nothing when I look at it in a whole. But suffering has been a good thing to me a little bit. I hurt and I get humble when I suffer. You know, it opens up something into me, you know. And I know there's a whole lot of people in history, them guys caused some harsh lifestyles. It was no cushy lifestyle, so maybe it's something, a lesson somewhere in suffering.
Well, there, as we heard in the talk this morning, there is a great lesson in suffering. And it seems that's the only way we learn. Through suffering, we become humble. And we become compassionate. Because everyone suffers. There's no, you know, the analogy that's given to us is this, that we are beings of light. We are beings of light. And as we descend into this plane of material existence, we are cloaked in matter, darkness. And we penetrate into the deepest part of matter. And then we begin to reemerge. Well, we are reemerging again. That light is beginning to shine again because it was covered up. We look in the history of humanity. You know, the Dark Ages. But while the Dark Ages were going on, there was a great cultural renaissance in the Middle East. And so where we've been and where we've come from ignorance. And we're going back into light. But it's a struggle. We have to find the meaning and the value of the suffering that we're enduring. Otherwise, we continue to suffer. Continue.
In the talk, we were surprised to hear in the beginning about pleasure. We thought that was unusual. And the more we listened, the more we understood, because the contrast is, if we come into this life with the karma that we have created, let's call them a set of lessons we have failed to learn in previous lives, we need to learn. We choose at every moment either pain or pleasure as we see fit. Am I going to spend the time and suffer a little and understand this lesson and be better prepared for the next one? Or am I going to opt for pleasure? And then it was described a different kind of pleasure we might call joy. It was mentioned compassion, service to others. And we know from personal experience, we probably all do, in the midst of our worst day, if we take a moment and reach out and do something for another, our worst day disappears for the amount of time that we spend serving another. So it's, as was said, where we place our mind, what we wrap our minds around for that period of time, the lesson's still waiting to be learned. So if we don't finish it, we know we need to do it in the future with more force. It will return with more force because we have resisted it. And finally, just that when we choose the pleasure, let us choose wisely the pleasure for ourselves or the joy of serving another.
We often see, you know, people who are suffering, and they just can't seem to break that cycle because they become self-absorbed in the suffering and they identify with the suffering and they're afraid to let it go because they become comfortable with the suffering. They know what it is. They know what to expect. It won't get worse, perhaps. It won't get better, but we know where we are and we're comfortable with that. But everyone around them is not, because everyone suffers because of the one who is so self-indulged with their pain. So we can't free ourselves from the suffering in the sense that, sure, we say to ourselves, well, if I had a lot of money, I would do great things. Well, we have a lot of money. Do you know we live in the richest country in the world? We have a lot of money. But what do we do with it? We're self-indulgent. Not that it's we're terrible people, but we've learned at a very early age that to survive, we have to do certain things. We have to obtain certain values. And to examine that is very painful, because our self-worth is derived from the position we hold within society, by the work that we do, by the associations that we keep. And many, the value of their life is only compared to the amount of money they have or the position they hold within the society. And these are all fleeting. These are all impermanent. The value of life is right here in this moment by what we give each other. And that giving can only transcend us if we go beyond, as said before, is try to help. But be guarded. Because if you help someone too much, you cripple them. We have to struggle. We need to struggle. We want to struggle. We want to find our own answers. But a helping hand is always needed.
Maya Angelou says it so beautifully. If you get, if you receive, give. If you learn, teach. And that probably is the biggest opportunity of life, is to gain the wisdom of how to give and how to teach.
Yes, and I think on a class recently, the idea of service was presented to us in such a way that we all serve. What do? We serve each other. What are our jobs? They're in the service of others. What of our families? We're in service to our families. We are born serving each other. It's only when we become blocked and selfish and separate does that service atrophy. But even then, we couldn't survive without service from others. The food we eat, the things that we do, the cars that we drive, everything is from someone else. Someone has participated in the things that we use and have. We don't live in a vacuum. We are connected. And service is the mantra of our existence. It's not so much what we can get, it's how can we help? How can we help? And that, and our mothers and fathers feel great joy when we are helpful. Even washing the dishes, helping with cooking, helping clearing the table, helping. We've had siblings that we didn't like when we were growing up because our mother and father loved them so much because they were always helping them. We always thought that they were sucking up. No, we always thought that they were trying to garner some favor. But in reality, they were doing that which they felt compelled to do. They felt great benefit by being an important part of that family. And that was by serving that family.
And the idea here is to study, sit back, think about it, and get a handle on personality, woe is me, I'm suffering, and so forth. And as was in the talk, who is it that's telling us the difference between pleasure and pain? Is there truly any difference? And are we sincerely affected? We heard a saying once, leave the ego out of it, and then there will be success. Always once. When we leave the personality.
Well, you mentioned in the prior question or statement that are we a witness? Are we observing everything that happens? And we do. You know, but what happens is that the personality is a life force unto itself. We've given it so much power. It's like we're a rider on this horse, and we've let the reins go, and the horse is just taking off down the road. Well, what we are told is that we need to be in control of the horse, of the personality. And the Gita is our guidebook of how to gain control over that horse, over that personality. Because if we do not, it leads to destruction. It leads to loss of all of hope. It leads to bewilderment. Because we are not this personality, but when we try to control it, we have a battle on our hands, a fierce battle, because it has so much power and control over us. Now we say, okay, now I'm in control. No, no way. It doesn't want to give it up, but we have to, through our will and our persistence, slowly gain control, pick up those reins, and steer this personality down that path of impersonality and greatness for everyone. But the personality is a tool, and we have to use it as such. Again, a reminder that All the activities of this lodge are carried on through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned. What did I do? I turned it on again? I had to turn it off?
That is off.